This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Thank you so much for joining us for our conversation today. This podcast has been developed as part of the Change Stories project. Change Stories is an international research partnership that aims to spark dialogue and learning through storytelling about urban change that supports sustainability, health, and well-being for all residents. In this project, we explore how urban grassroots movements, such as the Take Back the City campaign in Belfast, are creating spaces for sanctuary in the city while resisting infrastructural and colonial forms of violence. Our work also contributes to the growing literature on insurgent planning and collectivist approaches to urbanism, campaigns and organizing. We hope to explore and visions that can receive futures. Would you like to introduce yourself, Desi?
Yeah, thanks. My name is Desi Donnelly. I'm currently a member of the Rabble Tech Cooperative, which is a cooperative supporting social movements to use tech to affect change more effectively. Previous to that, I had worked with PPR for about 16 years. I was a member of the first kind of staffing cohort at PPR, and I left in around 2022.
Thank you. Sean?
Hey, it's Day. Thanks very much for getting us on the podcast. So I'm Sean McBrady, and I'm a community organizer with the Guardian Football Project, which is another wee baby of PPR kind of thing. Basically concentrating on how to get people involved in food, climate, energy initiatives in their own areas, and started with Guardian and Football in West Belfast, a disused community garden in the city. I previously worked full time for PPR with Halsul and Desi and everybody else in PPR on housing, asylum, unemployment, right to work, and before that, trade union organizer, before that, various other different sort of community roles, and I've been involved in the Irish language movement for many years, went to school and through the Irish language school system, so that was natural enough too.
Perfect, thank you.
Thank you, Azadia. My name is Tawassul Muhammad. I am also an organizer at PPR, worked with both Sean and Desi, worked with different campaigns, Take Back the City and Lift the Bank and Economy, mainly organizing with refugees and asylum seekers. And I'm also a refugee from Sudan, came to Belfast like 9 years ago. And before coming to Belfast, I was also involved in activism in Sudan. I grew up in under the regime of Muslim Brothers and army dictator. I spent most of existing that and then came to Belfast to continue to. After coming to Belfast, I also started with other colleagues of mine, Anaka Women's Collective, which is a collective for women mainly from the refugees and asylum-seeking community, but also open to all women in the community.
Amazing. Daisy, the city of Belfast is conventionally described as a divided city, marked by residential segregation, peaceful sectarian conflict, and competing communal identities. Much policy, academic, and media discourses frame Belfast as an arena of two communities, Protestant Unionist, is taken as of a special and political. Such a narrative obscures the deep historical processes use the city's special order. In your view, what is the best framework to understand current structuring of urban space and land governance in Belfast, its political and social dimension, and its impact on the contemporary land and housing inequality?
Going to start off with an easy question, Isaiah.
I wanted to allow you a lot of time to explore and reflect.
There's two dimensions, I think, to Belfast segregation or the division within the city. One would be class-based. That probably wouldn't be too different from other kind of Western countries. And then we have the sectarian division that exists in the city. And I suppose to understand that, you'd have to go back to examining how the city was divided. The division became more back in the 1960s when there were pogroms across the city, when mobs went in out of communities, particularly in areas like West Belfast and North Belfast, when you think of Bombay Street and that kind of iconic Bombay Street that was one of the catalysts behind the emergence of the Provisional IRA. But division was created through pogrom. And then during the conflict, during the war, that division was kind of institutionalized. Whenever the peace walls, or they call them the barricades, that kind of litter across working class areas of Belfast, were given an architecture. So physical walls were built to maintain security between different communities. And, you know, to a large extent at that time, people wanted those walls up. You know, people wanted the walls up in the sense that it did provide some element of, well, some protection to some degree from mob violence. However, then you have to look at how, you know, how far are we on now after the Good Friday Agreement, the peace agreement, almost 30 years after that. And very, very few of those walls have been taken down. And why that is, you have to look at the Belfast population and what interests are there to keep those walls and to keep the city divided. You know, in Belfast changed in the last 10 to 15 years. Once a bastion kind of unionist control, a kind of symbolism of the one-party state in terms of unionist control, has withered. It's no longer politically a unionist majority city. There's certainly a more diverse polity in the sense that you'll have everything ranging from Green Party to Sinn Féin to People Before Profit. You know, you have a kind of a diverse political landscape which now holds a majority within the city. But what goes alongside with that is a declining power. And that power is also kind of manifests itself in what would be previous when you talked about the kind of sectarian division in the city. Loyalist communities, urban working class loyalist communities are increasingly becoming one, more elderly, and number two, more depopulated, which then has an implication not only in terms of votes for unionist political parties, but it also then feeds into what do you do whenever you have a changing population, but a stagnant around those areas. Now, the solution to the housing crisis in class areas is to secure land or to use publicly available land to build new housing. But because of this, the sectarian division of the land, there's a block and there's essentially a veto that says we can't build over there because we can't. That is considered to be for want of a better term, ownership of one community, not the other community. So in some ways, that suits political interests that want to repopulate those areas, that want to kind of engineer or bring back their power base in certain communities, but it absolutely runs contrary to human need, human rights. And the thing is, because this housing crisis is so acute, you will get families moving into these communities, threats from loyalist families there. And I think it's agreed with a minority with communities that are exercising this violent control over these communities that are able to put out families who happen to be from Catholic background, or happen to be from an immigrant background, or happen to be from a non-white background, in a attempt to entrench single identity communities and keep the kind of political makeup and the demography of Belfast what it was back in the 1970s.
I think you set a very powerful introduction to our conversation. Sean, Belfast peace walls, interface barriers, and segregated neighborhoods are often explained as the legacy. Yet, when we pass to other colonial cities, Algiers, Cape Town, Mumbai, PPR's 2016 report showed that political will, rather than land availability or funding, is the primary barrier to addressing housing inequality and homelessness. Why do you think housing continues to function as a political tool in Belfast, used both to control land and to divide communities?
Desi set it up well in terms of like the context for a divided city and a walled city and a city with barricades. Where housing fits in that is the primary element of the patchwork quilt. And in the earlier year, it became obvious very quick in North Belfast, who had a direct correlation in the mind of powerful unionist political figures with their credits, their votes. So if power is built upon the premise of a contracting population, and this is sort of the story of Ireland, it's also the story of all those other countries that you name, where you basically have a contracting or a minority population trying to exert control over a majority. Like the story of Dublin is that story, the story of all the colonial institutions that emerge from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of the politic of Ireland. Women and kids who are living in hostels for years and years and years on end, less than 100 yards from available housing. I mean, but the housing's on the other wall, or less away from available land, available property, available resources, but that resource is deemed to be outside their gift, outside their purview. Girdwood was the perfect example of that, and Girdwood is essentially a microcosm of the state. Massive public resource, clearly had a potential to solve long-standing housing crisis with deep inequalities, structural inequalities, and instead of being built and allocated based on need and meeting need where it was at, it was turned into another one of the managing the peace projects, which essentially is a white elephant project established to do anything but rattle the status quo. And we've seen that time and time again. Took that powerful dynamic, which was consented to by most powerful people. You know, it was consented to. Like, the Girdwood deal was not a union project. It was consented to by nationalist politics, by the middle of the road politicians, by the, you know, there was no political voice there that was going against that deal. That deal was done by all. And it was the price of peace, if you imagine, to keep these women homeless. So they mapped out where the land was, where the money was, where the need was. And they developed their own agenda around that. And that was really, I think, a really critical factor in taking the promises of the Good Friday Agreement and turning them into actual tools for people on the ground, where you're not waiting for the powers that be to tell you where the answers are going to come from. You're going to season them yourself. And that imaginative approach has evolved into what's the stuff that Tausul and families are involved in today. Our politics has matured enough. The opportunity of a multicultural neighborhood in the past where homes are required. If it's the stale old sect politics of the past still, the jury's out. They look too good at the minute, but opportunities to fix their wagon if they want to.
It raises an important question about how peace is sometimes framed as maintaining the status quo rather than of inequality. With over 13,500 households in Belfast alone waiting for housing.
Child homelessness is clearly a major concern in Belfast. Thousands of children are living in a homeless situation, which can have significant adverse impacts on their education, health, and future outcomes.
Tawassul, in your view, what are the primary systemic and structural causes of homelessness in Belfast today? And how is your campaign addressing these challenges in practice?
Looking at homelessness, to me, the primary reasons are as simple as that people who have the power to change this, to solve the housing crisis, don't really care about people. At this last year, you'll find that more than £40 million was spent on temporary accommodation. This temporary accommodation, this money that was paid, it wasn't paid so that people can live in dignity or in the suitable accommodation. This money was paid to private landlords and to hotel owners just to keep people living in moldy houses and houses that need repair and maintenance and completely unsuitable accommodation. Like, if you look at the refugees and asylum seeking community, people come to the country and they join a base. These temporary and emergency accommodation people live in will be places where families will be moved from one place to another without asking them, without considering their life, how long they lived in a place where kids go to schools and all. Like, in the last few years, we have been supporting families who would have lived in Belfast for years and years, and then all of a sudden, housing executive will be sending them to another city, sometimes a city that is 2 hours away from Belfast on public transport. And you're talking about families who most of the time don't speak English, haven't been here long. Kids can't go to school because it's far away and can't move to a closer school. So you don't know if you are going to be here tomorrow or not. we're talking about money that's spent and given to private landlords like MIRS. MIRS is a company, if you know, that's responsible for the accommodation of asylum seekers. And if you have heard the news in the last couple of weeks, they got a profit, like £14 million profit over the threshold that the government set for public contracts. So they made extra profit on this contract. And when we were talking about this with the families, we have been supporting because we worked with families who stayed in MIRS accommodation for years and years. And I was explaining to this mom about this extra profit MIRS made. And this is a single mom. And I know that because we were supporting her from PPR, and they live in the type of accommodation. They're not given money by the Home Office. They are given pounds per week per person. But then this food that's provided was like, she sent me photos of the food. So it was like 5 bananas per week. So she was like, how could they make all this money and then don't give me just food, like something as simple as that? I think if the same money that is spent and given to these landlords, private companies, is spent properly, like spent on building social houses suitable for people to live in, that will be better for everyone. What we do is we campaign around different sites. Like Sean said, families identified a few empty sites in Belfast, and this last one we are campaigning around Mackies is publicly owned, and it's in an area with the highest housing demand, so it makes sense for social houses to be built there. And this is what we are focusing on now, like working with homeless families from different backgrounds, from different communities, all of us trying to get houses there, social houses for everyone.
Excellent. I would like to shift the conversation slightly. Can you tell us a bit about, for example, what were the political conditions and forces that led to the emergence of PPR? And how did it take shape within the broader political culture from which it inherited its organizational practices, ideological orientations, and modes of mobilization?
I think PPR bears the kind of the mark of its founder, Agnes McCormick. She was a kind of lifelong trade unionist, feminist. She was a signatory to the McBride Principles of Fair Employment in the 1980s, which were a kind of transformative impact on the conflict here. And from the kind of social partnership mode of practice for the trade union. So she spent her presidency going around the island, reaching out to various, I suppose, social movements, groups, so women's groups, country, organizations, trade union branches. I suppose, remember that PPR was kind of founded and in its early thing was always a cross-border project. It was always an all-Ireland project, but at the very, very beginning, it was a coalition, and it was a coalition of the trade union movement, civil liberties organizations, so CHA in the north and the Irish Council of Civil Liberties in the south. There was a community foundation in the north. There was various kind of community organizations in the south. And I think it was formed as, in a kind of a frustration as to both states on this island. In the north, this was around probably 2003, 2004. And then I think PPR keeps to this day is this kind of, I don't know, like strategic impatience with where things are at. It's not a kind of an anarchic kind of thing, but it's very much saying, no, it's not enough. We will not work with what it is right now. And I think whenever you had that kind of coalition of all these groups, and you know, we started, the first kind of staff were employed. It was thinking, well, what's our organizing model? How do we go about? What do we do? And I think it was initially anyway. And I think that like some of the beauty of PPR is that, you know, it evolves. It doesn't stay still. The organizing might have kind of a similar value, which we'll go into in a second, but it kind of reflects the personalities and the skills. Yes, the inequalities that both created and fueled and sustained the conflict, and they exist today. And part of the agreement was that these inequalities would have to be dealt with. So there was this technical term, Section 75 of the Northern Ireland Act. But it basically said that the state has an obligation to tackle inequalities if it is evidence that inequalities exist. That sounds like just an administrative thing, but actually the guidance behind it was fueled by participation. What it said was not only do you have to tackle that inequality, but the people who are most impacted by that inequality have to be an integral part of the decision-making process. So in some ways, it was an attempt to kind of bypass representative democracy and use participative democracy to tackle inequality and poverty. Now, that's the maximal kind of definition and the kind of or interpretation of it that social movements could kind of use to do that. But the problem with these things is that, you know, the Section 75 gets into legislation, it translates, and they've got this architecture and staff with 40 to 50. Every public authority has a policy officer, and then all civil society now have policy officers who are equality officers, you know, charged with engaging in the system. And so then you have something, so every time a public authority needs to make a decision, then it has to do something called an equality assessment, impact assessment. And suddenly, this kind of transformational thing, which was about kind of targeting inequalities, generating participation so that those furthest away from the table be involved in it, becomes a matter of procedural compliance. So did they tick that box there? Did they tick that box there? And the people further are not involved in the process at all. It is mostly professionalized class of policy officers. But of course, with us, it was just like, well, of course, we're going to go housing. We just need to figure out how to do it. So that's when we started organizing initially in the Seven Towers in North Belfast, because we said, well, who is furthest away from here? When you look at Catholic inequality in housing in the North, which is systemic, it's still, you know, systemic today, who's furthest away? So we looked at women who, most of them single mothers, young women in the Seven Towers, which includes a hostel as well, and we started organizing with them. And then it was a case of, well, how do we use all of these pieces of paper and legislative commitments as organizing tools to try to put pressure on political power to deliver that as well, you know? So the organizing model, I would say, from that, that's the kind of political context it came out of. I think it was also, we worked with community groups between PPR and community development practice. And that also means that you look in a critical kind of lens to what the state does, and you have to develop a robust challenge to that. Community development practice at the time was still in the mode of, let's give peace a chance. The institutions are still bedding down. You know, things just need to be worked through. We need to give politicians time. And we were saying, absolutely not. Now's a time where it shouldn't bed down, because if it beds down in this, we're screwed, because this is going to be the trajectory for the next 20, 30 years, which is what happened, you know, as opposed to, like, you have to go in there and kind of tear it up a bit and kind of be a bit of the upstarts, you know. I can't imagine the British government cared too much, really. But what using that framework allowed us to do was pull in rapporteurs from Geneva, allies from Brazil, allies from Kenya, from South Africa. It looks like, for all intents and purposes, there's an international spotlight of what's going on here. And suddenly the international narrative is not so much, look at these two historic communities coming together in this magnificent peace process and bedding down peace. It's that what Sean said before and what Aidan said is, what's happening is that political progress and deals for political progress is being broken on the backs of the poor. And the poor here are the ones that are being left behind. And yes, we're creating plenty of upward mobility, particularly for Catholics who are moving out of working class communities to middle class communities, but actually you're not changing the class, and also within that, then the inequality, the religious inequality.
I would like to ask you, Sean, about the kind economy work that PPR does and how that translates into the urban regeneration. Since PPR grounds its work in the principles of a kind economy and ethical solidarity, its approach to urban regeneration must also be understood through that lens. Can you tell us a bit about the idea of kind economy and how these shape model of PPR's organizing? And how do these principles influence the ethos and strategies of the campaigns, particularly in relation to urban regeneration and movement building?
Another easy one, isn't it?
I've selected carefully.
Flexible. To explain to your listeners what is the kind economy, and from PPR's perspective, but as I remember it, the kind economy campaign, I can remember conversations with Alfie and other organizations with people who were being put through the Home Office asylum system. Just totally degraded. I mean, the hostile environment, as it was called and as it is basically obviously a racist tool to break the back of people who are being forced to flee climate change, war, destitution, abuse all over the world, and people who are coming to embrace international rights for asylum, that within the corridors of Westminster, you know, a deeply racist kickback. I mean, you see this all over the world. You see this in the politics of America. You see this, and you always have seen that the weak over the head by the powerful blocked out of the potential to support themselves or their families through the work ban, through the, like, the marginalization, even the categorization of people into hotel units instead of living in communities. You know, even all those changes were all an effort to isolate out an asylum populace, to classify them as a drain on society, and then to use them as a political tool to maintain the power of white privileged men in Westminster and white privileged men locally, to put it bluntly. So when we were organizing on that, the Lift the Ban campaign, as it was about lifting the ban on asylum seekers having the capacity to go to work to earn monies, rather than being manned and left in a sort of economic black hole. What can our contribution be in this context? Like, how do we evolve? So these were conversations amongst asylum seekers, refugees, supporters, activists, you know, that kind of thing, that led to us. And there's a thing we do in PPR constantly, which is to map power, to do a power map, to ask yourself the question, where does the power come from to do the thing to us, or where can we get power to make our thing happen? And we started looking around this sort of latent network that had been building for years and seeing a lot of economic power within the network. So there were businesses and there were people who were, you know, really sound people who weren't racist white supremacists, you know what I mean? Those people with that ethos and that weight, and the way it manifested was a group of businesses, a group of people with needs for goods and services, a good group of people with skills and capacity created this, what we call the kind economy. So it was a small sort of local Belfast-based organising effort to basically do something a bit bigger, which is break the economic backbone behind the racist policy. And it landed a lot of the other campaigning, like the right to work, right to welfare, people who are unemployed, and also in the housing sphere. Like, homelessness is highly profitable. There are a lot of people making millions of pounds out of homelessness. The vast majority of people who are officially homeless here aren't living on the streets. They're living in a private landlord's accommodation, and the private landlord is getting welfare. They're getting the housing benefit. They're making a mint. And then you've got these cluster landlord groups and bigger landlord groups. And where are all they? You know, like, how many of the MLAs are landlords and how many of the councillors? I actually seen one when I was walking around here today. Guy that owns about 110 properties in the university area. I was asking all those questions. That's what kind of economy came from. It came from people saying, well, where's our power? Where do we have weight? Where do we have resources? And how can we stop going with the begging bowl to people who aren't going to get our power ourselves? And then the concept of mehel, like that old understanding that our community needs something. Our community has the skills to deliver that something, and we might need resources that are either being extracted from our community or are beyond our community, but we can leverage them. So let's do it. Na habere jane, don't say it, do it. Get our people together and let's get at it. So those two things for me are naturally blended concepts or ideas, and I actually think are a big part of the solution to the problems we face in the world at the minute, that communities become more organized, more mobilized.
Something which quite fascinates me about how you recreate the concept of mehel in Garden of Oboil, the community garden in Belfast, in bringing people to the land, bringing children to the land. And a few times when I had the opportunity as well to join, you showed us the remaining Irish rainforest and you explained to us that the Irish were the forest people. And I wanted to hear from you how that experience is connected to the way you understand change in city, the kind of change that you want to see in Belfast.
The thing of the forest people, like, so Ireland is... And these are things I've come to learn this last load of years working on the community garden and rewilding projects with other people. So everything I say here is an idea that came out of someone else's head, like, you know what I mean? So Ireland is the worst country in Europe for natural tree coverage. That's not an accident. We've been massively exploited centuries, that pre-Christian sort of pagan singularly focused on how important the land, the sun, the sea, the stars and all of that, that is, the harvests and moving with that rhythm. That culture has been also totally decimated or almost completely decimated. So if you think about it, the Irish language is one element of sort of destruction there. The Irish land is the other element. And if you travel around Ireland, you see green fields and green mountains. And such is the shift in baseline in our consciousness, is that many of us find that to be beautiful. And in fact, many of us want a nice, prim, trimmed lawn, much like the aristocracy would have had when they took over all the land. I'll give you an example of it. Last weekend, we were in the Belfast Hills with the Black Mountain Rewilding Group, about 30 sort of community activists there. Some of them there on behalf of their kids, and we climbed up the mountains and we planted 250 native trees. Not really different to a lot of, you see this happening, but hippy-dippy stuff all over the place. Except for me, it's about the connections in that project. So all of those trees were looked after, were foraged, planted and maintained in schools and youth clubs across the city. And you'll find that there are hundreds of people connected to just that small batch of trees. So when you take the initiative and you go back up the hills and you bring back the forest of the future by planting oak trees that'll grow for 400 years, you're doing that with and on behalf of all the kids who came to the gardens all year round, and some of the kids were up with us, who are planting them and minding them and asking themselves the questions like, why don't we have trees? Where did our trees go? What's going to happen next? For me, next generation are the people who will raise up, take the land back and return it to its former glory and work out a way for us all to live sort of in peace and harmony on it, if that's not too hippy-dippy for you.
That's very touching, and because I've been at the land with you and the kids, and I found that experience very enriching, and it always makes me think about, when we talk about urban change, these are the kind of changes that we don't often see. Like another change which you mentioned about the connection between the land and the language. And we now have a growing Irish-speaking community in Belfast. In your view, how this growing Irish-speaking community has transformed Belfast last 30 years?
Well, one of the obviously ones that we have a greater population now who can Irish. And that isn't just as simple as being able to speak a language that isn't English. That's about, like, again, asking those questions. Belfastia, that turn into Belfast. What does it mean as Belfast? What does Belfastia mean? Or, you know, people being able to go on a journey to seriously ask questions about where we came from, where we are and where we're going, I think is connected in a language as well. But it's not good enough to simply push for language. Like, you can end up with petty nationalism, you know what I mean? You can end up with petty flag waving, petty nonsense there. It has to be about class. It has to be about social and economic rights. It has to be about equilibrium and nature and climate rights and all of that stuff. Because the last thing I would say that those sort of pioneers of the modern Irish language movement in Belfast would want is any version of the what you're seeing now in the South, those Irish rate talking about Ireland first people. You know, that the antidote to that, in my view, is what has emerged in the Irish language movement, which is cross-cutting and embracing and multicultural and multi-platform and intersectional and all of that type of stuff. So, I mean, obviously I would say that. I came through the Irish language school, so I'm going to say something good about it. Someone else might say something not so good. But for me, we received a revolutionary education, and that's a good thing. And we went through revolutionary and radical processes in our education, and that has turned out a lot of people who are turning their skills to the next sort of phase of that. And in every room that I walk into, whether they're activists, I can find people who are fluent Irish language speakers. That's not unique to that one community and that one language, but it's certainly there is something in how business is being done there that's turning out what I believe to be a good calibre of people.
There were some very interesting conversations came about the connection between Irish language activists. And I know as an activist from Sudan yourself, you have been involved in many of the projects organized by, for example, Garden of Oboyle, Glenomona and other Irish community organizations. One particular initiative which I think you contributed was the Irish Language Anti-Racism Charter, which was launched a few months ago. And I recall that day there was food prepared by Kind Economy chefs, and you had very beautifully organized that event. A lot of is coming from near and to the area. I would like to hear about how you would see your engagement with such an initiative.
First, speaking about Irish language community and Irish language campaign in Belfast, as soon as I arrived and I started working with PPR and meeting different activists and speaking about the struggle people went through to get rights to their language and all. And then we started speaking about different indigenous languages around the world. And like in Sudan, we had so many languages before the British came. And the British also forced Sudanese people who had more than 200 local languages before the British came. They forced them all to speak one language, Arabic, which isn't English, but it was Arabic because they were accompanied by Egyptians. Even the British started in Sudan. They didn't allow kids to speak their Nubian language in schools, and like the kids were threatened. They were forced to speak Arabic. So I think this is one of the first things I noticed, like these shared experiences within the Sudanese community in Belfast. There is a big Nubian Sudanese community, and the first thing I thought of was introducing the Nubian Sudanese community to the Irish language campaigners, which turned into a great collaboration. Like the Sudanese Nubian Association, they do a lot of activities with the Irish language campaigners in the garden and in the center. And I have so much respect for the Irish language campaigners for all they did to preserve their culture and language. And I remember going on a tour with Sean, I think, in the cemetery in West Belfast. And I know for people who grew up here and who fought against the colonization and all, I know they feel like they haven't achieved all they wanted, the liberation, the land and all. But looking at it coming from Sudan, which is still at war and new wars start every day with the displacement, with the genocide and all. And I just respect everything people did. It's still way to go and to achieve more and all, but still they achieved a lot. Going to the Kind Economy and all the work we did with Gloria Mona and all, to me, the most unique Kind Economy is that it's presenting migrants as an asylum-seeking community. This is not to say charity isn't needed. It is much needed, especially when people arrive new in the country. And most of the time they arrive with nothing because they spend their money on the journey to arrive here, and they need help with basic things like food, like clothes, and it's not just money, but also the social support. Most families arrive here, they don't speak English, and they know no one, and they are isolated most of the time. So they need this help and support. But also people quickly feel like they don't want just charity. And I hear this every day when people join the Kind Economy. Like people come to the Kind Economy and feel the difference because they are not going to charities to get help and support and donations. They are actively contributing to the community here and giving their time and their skills and qualification. Maybe we didn't go as a Lift the Ban campaign and speak about anti-racism and the struggles of refugees and asylum seekers. But because it's around food and different cultures, it brings people together and makes it easier for local people to understand the shared things more than the differences between us. Like people have normal conversations about their kids and schools and just normal life instead of all the blaming refugees for the lack of housing and lack of services.
Tavassul, thank you so much for the very powerful and emotional sharing of your experience as a person coming from Sudan with your very rich background of activism in your own country and bringing that rich experience to Belfast and building the campaign here. I mean, you're one of the key people in the movement building Back the City campaign, Kind Economy campaign. And I think that there is this quote from Audre Lorde who says, activism is not a single dimensional thing. You can't just be activist in one section, in one thing, and forget about the rest. And I've seen how you're deeply motivated and engaged within your own community, Sudanese community, but also with many other communities, women from Anaka, Vile, people like yourself who are very important in creating this campaign, are often cast down and not really given the visibility. So my question is, how does your campaigning and activism challenge these colonial and sectarian logics?
I feel privileged to work in PPR, all the amazing activists there, but also to be paid for this job, because I couldn't afford to do this in Sudan, because activism in Sudan was always something you do as extra or on the side. You don't usually get paid to do it. And usually people who work in human rights organizations and get paid, most of the time it becomes more of a business and a career than being activist. So I'm happy to be doing this. And then I came into PPR and everyone have been working here for a long time and they're familiar with the context and it's their country, their history and their culture. So the new thing I could bring to PPR is working with my community and refugees and asylum seeking communities. It's not just refugees and asylum seekers fighting for their rights, but they are fighting for the rights of everyone in the community, all the marginalized people and people who live in poverty. And that's how I feel about it, even when I'm subjected to racism. Like I went to one of the protests and I was in the front line and there was a woman on the other side. And as soon, like they were chanting and all, but as soon as she saw me, she started directing all the hate, calling me names and all. Feel angry at me, but why are you doing this? You should be on the same side. So working, for example, in the Take Back the City campaign, people come to the campaign with housing issues. If it's houses with mold or damp or maintenance problems or people being homeless, and people come from different backgrounds. And they usually come for their problems to be solved. But then they come to the campaign group and find other people who are still in housing stress or who got their issues solved, but they are still there to help other people. And then for local people who are thinking of refugees as people who come and take their benefit and take their houses, and then they meet them and they see like these are moms who just want a good life for their kids, and then the conversations and the relationships then brings people to think how we solve this together. And then you see when a local white woman is being evicted from her house, and then women from the refugees community and from the Kind Economy come to the house to help her resist the eviction, and they bring food and they support and all. And I think this is best about movement building.
So Daisy, you already explained about the PPR philosophy and their ethos and the organizing models. I would like to explore a little bit about the strategies that PPR has adopted in order to enact the human rights framework. PPR is widely recognized for its human rights-based approach to organizing. What, in your view, are the defining features of this approach?
These strategies, you know, At a core, it's about participation. You know, it's about seeing who's marginalized. And then what PPR does brilliantly is bring in an organizer and a policy resource behind that and other alliances as well, and works with a group to kind of let them define what their problem is. You know, maybe give some kind of policy architecture around that. So what's the state's obligation doing, what it isn't doing? And then say, for example, with doing that, I say, well, how do we make the reality? Like Sean before about the more kind of mutual aid approach and building the shell or building the new and the shell of the old. I think, you know, that in its early days, I think PPR strategies were very much pivoted towards an accountability-based model where we were, for want of a better term, you know, the dynamic was we're asking the state to do something, but we're asking them to do something that they've committed to doing. So we're trying to hold them to account and we're pulling every tactic and strategy we can to try to force power to live up to its commitments. And maybe it's something, I suspect it's not, but it's our own kind of unique situation that we have a broken political system in the North. You know, it's evident for anyone with their eyes open that this place is not going anywhere new. Certainly is delivering some change for people and is certainly getting solutions, but it's not getting the structural change that's required. So I think there was a shift through the kind economy, through the housing organizing, through the right to work, where we started to go, yes, the accountability work still needs to proceed, but how do we start doing more autonomous organizing where we're starting to develop community-based solutions that don't give the state a veto over progress? So what Sean was talking before about Michal, how do we look at our assets? How do we look at the resources the community have and start solving the problems ourselves? Not that you're going to do it in isolation, but actually you show them that it can be done and try to gather momentum around that to build kind of bigger momentum. But it changes the way you're dealing with the state because now you're not going, please do that for it. You're saying we're going to do it anyway. We need our people who have experience of going to a public authority to try to get their issues solved multiple times, being knocked back, being degraded, being humiliated. What was the problem? Pinpoint what the problem is. You went to him. What did he say? You went to him. What did he say? Okay. Well, then we're not going to do that. We're going to circumvent that. And it's about building strategies based on people's experience, not some sort of abstract theoretical model about that. And then you just need, I think, the human element to be able to kind of nurture the strategies with people.
Thank you so much, Daisy. I want to ask a further question on something you said about how you build on your relationship with people in order to develop strategies. In a way, the work with PPR has always shown me how the everyday work is so relational. It very much depends on how people relate to each other and how they create a space and how this space is always collective. It's not owned by anyone. And unlike many NGOs that I have worked before, there is no established hierarchy in PPR. What I found interesting is how we could think of this model of organizing and campaigning in a broader scale. Because from my own experience of working in few countries and different NGOs, I have not really come to any organization with this kind of structure, which has been able to sustain itself for quite a long period.
The first thing about the kind of structure, PPR has the structure of an NGO. It has a board, it's got the directors, it has funders, it's accountable and all that. But I think it's more about the values of the people in the organization and the disposition of the people in the organization. So the danger is always there that an organization like that could revert back to a more hierarchical kind of mode of working. But I think just the organizing model is so ingrained and related to PPR that, you know, it's the people that are running, the people involved in the campaigns are the people that make the tactical and strategic decisions about the campaign. And then what you have is PPR, so the policy officers, the board, their allies, to support. Kind of first kind of conferences we had was fast. We brought over housing experts from Brazil and Kenya and Canada to sit on a panel and hear from people and human rights standards. And the minister at the time was Margaret Ritchie, the housing minister. And she heard that it was going on, but she didn't hear about it was going on until she got the press release the day before, because we kept it very quiet, all the kind of element of surprise. And, you know, we were doing that. And that night she phoned Inez and she said, can we meet to discuss this? And Inez says, certainly we can meet, but you won't be meeting me. You're going to meet the women who live there and you're going to meet them in their community. And the minister couldn't do that. Now, any other organization, you would have an egotistical, and I don't mean that necessarily as a character judgment, but just the model of people who usually take director jobs. Okay. PPR has never been a mass organization. But again, I go back to the point, it's not necessarily the structure. It's about the value base of the people within that structure and the culture and the organization culture there. The second thing about the North, you know, I don't know if that's intentional or not. I mean, I don't think it's intentional. I think you just have contradictions, and contradictions at the core of our governance that are unfolding to the degree that they seem to be irreconcilable. And, you know, we did go through a long hiatus in the North when we didn't have an executive, and that executive wasn't there because of a basic failure of political unionism, accept the rights of the state and moving towards you reach kind of an intractable positions in inflexible governance. That, look at our health service, look at our housing system. It's not so much that we're in a really bad state, it's that you don't see any way out of this stuff, you know? So people are naturally going to look to, where's the dynamic that I can actually change this? And that's what's up for grab right now with the whole referendum debate and all this sort of stuff, you know?
Another thing I'm curious about is how this organizing model interacts with institutions like government or housing authorities. When you're negotiating with more hierarchical systems of power, does the collective and relational approach create challenges, or does it actually strengthen the community's ability to push for change?
What are the dynamics that you create to kind of engage with government, yet at the same time disengage?
Yeah, and this is the thing. I don't think it's an intentional strategy to disengage with government. I mean, I'll go back again to what Diana's always said, is you always have to give people the opportunity to do the right thing. You know, you're not trying to set out to show that they're so inflexible. You know, you go with your demand, you go with your creativity, you go with your answer as well, and you try to work with them. And sometimes that works. My point is that tends to be on a case-by-case basis as opposed to a structural basis, you know? And structural change doesn't happen because there are a few good individuals in there.
Amazing. I'll now go to Sean. This is the last question. Thank you so much for your patience. PPR campaigners have long drawn inspiration from urban grassroots movements in other post-conflict.
PPR has a rich history of traveling to learn, traveling to show solidarity and open your arms to people who travel here for the same thing, that reciprocity kind of thing. I had lots of opportunity to go and learn from movements across the world because of the organizing in PPR and because of like people like Desi and others who were going, let's find out a bit about what's going over there, or, you know, I'm trying to make those connections. And it probably, I mean, this is not a PPR thing either. Like, Ireland, in one sense, is a very internationalist place. You know, we do have a legacy of colonialization, of oppression. So there's correlations. So in one way, like in a very selfish way, internationalism is about like picking up good practice from all over the world in places that are delivering on it. In another way, it's a duty and an obligation to use whatever weight or power that you have for your comrades across the world, you know what I mean? The people who need it, but not doing it in that sort of patronizing sort of way that you see often. So learning from people what their struggles may need from yours and digging within your own struggles to find what kind of solidarity could come from abroad and international struggles. And then also all of that layering and institutionalization of the totally abnormal happens because it happens in the dark and it happens closed in the Northern Ireland framework, where people are justifying it themselves as the price of a peace. But when you bring the international lens to bear on that, in any way, even the international activist class or, you know, people from South Africa are coming here and going, really? That's how it goes? And the flip of that, for me, there's massive potential. The things that PPR have always done is to say our local system of power, control, and that isn't right. The primary purpose of an organiser is to do the listening, to find the ways to do the listening so that you can hear what people are saying, the problem actually is, and the very specifics of it that could only be known to those people, could only be known to a group of women living in tower blocks or a group of residents on the Shankill Road whose streets are littered with glass, and or a group of people who've been through mental health services and facilities who've had direct, or a group of people who've come through a migration system that's racist and so on. The only real way to get to the actual on-the-ground problems is to do that organising on the ground and to do that listening on the ground, and then to find ways to turn those issues that have been raised into strategies. For example, Belfast City Council have legions of employees, millions of pounds of capital flowing around, policy officers and press officers and blah, blah, blah. But when you organise in communities, like particularly around, for example, community gardening, you find out that they don't exist on the ground. They actually don't exist in that layer. So you're stronger. You can organise there. You can mobilise communities there. And you can get away with, like, I remember Bernadette Mikulski saying this about when Stormont was down. I mean, let's see what we can get away with when they're not looking. You know what I mean? So you find that power is very weak there. Maybe they're round every once in a while for an election, or round every time there's a bad news story or something.
I really appreciate your time, your wisdom, your insights, and a lot of food for thought, I'm sure, for everyone who listens to this podcast. Thank you.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigee.io.